And you can say that. Okay, let's move to 1044, please.
Adopt the Climate Change Preparation Strategy and Associated Risk and Vulnerability Assessment to reduce climate-related vulnerabilities for residents and businesses and respond to impacts as they occur.
Our Planning and Sustainability Director is bringing a show-and-tell item, as well as a distinguished county commissioner and our auditor and others that are here to speak about this today. So I think we've got a great team lined up in your panels this morning to talk about this. Just a little reflection. I was on the council in 1993 when we adopted our first climate change strategy. And there's been some water under the bridge, if I can use a bad pun, since then that has changed everyone's understanding of how important this work is. We've made a lot of progress. Some of us have the opportunity to brag elsewhere about our progress, and we have, as a city, done more and gone further than other cities have. But we have a lot of work to do, and that's why the award is wonderful, and I know Susan and our team will talk about the award, but we also have a great deal of work to do. So with that, I'll let you start, Susan. Thank you all for being here this morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor, City Council. So Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And yes, we do have show and tell and special guests for you this morning. So for the past 20-plus years, Portland has been working with business partners, with utilities, with the state, metro, the county, and thousands of residents in every single neighborhood in the city on planning and sustainability solutions to reduce carbon emissions. Our efforts have been very successful. Michael will tell you more about the success the city has had over the past 20 years. And our work has been recognized nationally and internationally. Just recently, Portland was commended as one of only 10 cities in around the world to receive an award from the C40 Climate Leadership Group. The C40 is a network of the 40 largest cities in the world. Obviously, we're not one of the 40 largest. Portland and a few other smaller cities that were sort of ahead of the curve on these issues has been asked to join the group so that we can push forward this work kind of all together. So they kind of think of us as, they think of Portland as the cool little sister to the big kids. But unfortunately,
the smart little sister.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe so. But, I think in some ways we're not really that smart. It's only that we're grading on a curve, and no city is really doing that well. We've got a long way to go. We have so much work ahead of us if we're really to reach our goal of an 80% reduction in carbon emissions by 2050 and be prepared for the changes that are ahead and that the changes that have already started to happen. So why don't Michael present the mayor with this award?
Very
and
cool.
And
it's very cool. It's very heavy.
It's
yes.
Very heavy.
All right. We're gonna put it right up here where everybody can see it and enjoy it.
There you go.
It's a lot of good work by great. Not only members of this council, but also a lot of people in our bureaus, some of whom are here to talk about this today over quite a few years. But it's an honor.
Yeah. And much of this work, is with Commissioner Saltzman back
right.
over the past
right.
10, led
this
15
one.
Years. So I very much appreciate his leadership on this. In terms of the change in climate, climate preparation or adaptation is an issue that, unfortunately, we're starting to hear a lot more about. We recently completed our climate preparation strategy, and we'll present that today. The strategy was developed jointly among many different bureaus in the city, the county, private business partners. We had external advisors, scientists, and experts. What they found is that, in many ways, Portland is extremely fortunate compared to much of the world, especially compared to coastal cities, compared to places that are already very arid. But even so, we're beginning to see the impacts related to heat, related to human health, related to water temperature and precipitation. The reports that you have in front of you explain just what those impacts are or are projected to be and just how vulnerable we might be. Before I turn over the presentation to Michael Armstrong and Michelle Krim, Commissioner Bailey has to take off in a few minutes. So I thought, as a partner, the city and county have done this work together now for over a decade, and so we asked them to come here, and then we're going to go over there later this week to do the same presentation, but I wanted to have the commissioner say a few words about the county's participation. Thank you.
Welcome, Commissioner Bailey. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you, Susan. Thank you to all of you for the opportunity to be here. I'm Jules Bailey. I'm county commissioner for District 1. It's a pleasure to be with you, Mayor, and commissioners, and to be able to be part of the team from Multnomah County that's here to cheer you on and to say that we're going to be doing our part. This has been a joint city-county action plan that's going to take a coordinated strategy, and I salute the city for your incredible award. I think it's evidence of the continuity of leadership that the city has had over time. Mayor Hales, you referenced that, and also to the work that still needs to be done, and the county is ready to engage with you on that work. I think it is clear that climate change is one of the greatest threats that we face. And it is also clear that climate change, the impacts of that, are disproportionately felt by those who can sometimes least afford it and who struggle most. At Multnomah County, we deal with the underserved primarily, and it will require all hands on deck to ensure that as we work with communities that are struggling from the results of climate change, as we deal with the influx of potential climate refugees into Portland, as we ensure that we have equity as a core part of our sustainability strategy, that Multnomah County will stand hand in hand with the city as we engage on that effort. And more than that, Mayor, as you know, we have the pleasure of co-chairing the levies committee. We will see infrastructure impacts for climate change as well. Mm-hmm. We will see increased flooding requiring a rebuilding of our levees. We will see increased electricity use to deal with severe weather events. Multnomah County runs energy assistance programs that will be even more critical. And even things like disease vectors, as we look at increased disease spreading and mosquito-borne illnesses, Multnomah County Vector Control, Department of Emergency Management, and others stand ready to work with you on implementing this plan and making sure that we're ready for anything that comes our way. So this will be a long process. I'm honored to be part of the team at Multnomah County doing this, and I would cheer you on and note that at our commission meeting tomorrow, we will be tackling the same subject. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for your partnership. Thanks very much.
So before I turn it over to Michael and Michelle, I did want to thank the other bureaus and the other partners that were a part of this. From BES, Alice Brawley-Chesworth and Caitlin Lovell. From Water, Lorna Stickle, who's retired, but who all of us know and has been a part of this process, and many others. Kavita Hine, also from the Water Bureau. The County Office of Sustainability, Tim Lynch, the County Health Department, Carrie Lyon Eubanks and Matt Davis, and at my own office, Michelle, Ingrid Fish, and Roberta Jortner. After Michelle and Michael do their brief presentation, we have three other people who want to be a part of this presentation. Joanne Fuller, who is the director of County Health, to talk about her perspective on the health issues related to increasing temperatures in particular. And then invite my colleagues, Dean Marriott from the Bureau of Environmental Services and Mike Houck from the Planning and Sustainability Commission.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Commissioner. Again. See you soon. Appreciate your help on this. Michael and Michelle.
Great. So I'm Michael Armstrong. I manage sustainability programs for the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I'm going to offer a little bit of context for this work and then let Michelle talk through the details of this strategy. So as Mayor, as you said and as Susan referenced, Portland has a long history of working on climate change. I personally like to carry around the 5 1/4 inch floppy diskettes that contain the data from the first climate action plan back in 1993.
There's an artifact.
Exactly. Mostly because it amuses my colleagues, which is part of my job.
It's because I did those, and he likes to show how old I am.
Are there still machines that play those things?
None that BTS allows.
for which we
are grateful. So on the one hand, it seems like we were sort of impossibly ahead of our time. And on the other hand, I guess I would point out that we adopted our first carbon dioxide reduction strategy in 1993. A year before, in 1992, then President George Bush signed the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change that came out of the Rio Earth Summit. So this work has not been radical. It has been responsible. And so I think we're continuing that tradition today, doing the prudent thing and preparing for the climate change that we're already experiencing. So we have this history of working on this issue, and we have encouraging results to show in terms of reducing carbon. So the chart in front of you shows emissions associated with Multnomah County activities, so community-wide throughout Multnomah County in the blue line on the bottom. Compared to the national trend at the top, there's a real gap that opens there over the course of the 2000s. That's very encouraging. I think it's a sign of our early work. There's no single thing that made that line move, but it's really a combination of a whole host of efforts that Susan referenced around energy efficiency in buildings, in appliances, more fuel-efficient vehicles. It also has to do with transitioning to lower carbon energy sources, more solar, wind, geothermal, also some shifts away from things like fuel oil, which are very carbon intensive. It also has to do with things like shifting toward more biking, walking, and transit. So all of these things together roll up into these numbers. And this trend is encouraging because I think it reflects our early work. It's also encouraging because the national trend has started to bend down, and we absolutely need to see that. If we're out on our own and no one is following us, that's not going to end up helping, and it is one reason we do participate in things like the C40. So this needs to be an effort much larger than just Portland. So that too is encouraging. We also recognize, as Susan alluded, that the climate is already changing and we're expecting to see more change. And so while the early climate work was focused primarily on reducing carbon emissions, we also have begun to evaluate and really put into place strategies for dealing with the changes we're experiencing. This is a graphic that shows how almost all the work we do on climate change either reduces carbon emissions or it helps create a community that's able to succeed over time, even with changes in the climate. And it also reflects that a lot of the things we need to do help on both these fronts. And so those are the items in the middle. Almost all of these activities aren't only one or the other. They're all gradations. But this gives a sense for, saving energy in our homes clearly reduces carbon emissions. Similarly, doing a better job with flood management clearly is going to equip us better to deal with the changes we're expecting in precipitation. But there are a lot of things in between. A lot of our land use planning needs to support both. Things like natural systems, eco-roofs, green infrastructure, they're going to be an important part of how we handle changes in our rain patterns. They also help sequester carbon, keep the city cool, which then requires less energy to cool our buildings. So a lot of these strategies do both. As we went into this strategy development process, as Susan noted, this is a city-county joint effort, which is really important because so many of these issues span things like physical infrastructure and how that ends up affecting public health. And so we really want to do this hand in hand with the county. A lot of what we do affects how they end up needing to do their work and vice versa. And so it's been really important to do that jointly. We still needed to break the work down into some pieces just to make it manageable. And so we organized the effort around three sort of topic areas: infrastructure and the built environment, natural systems, and then health and human services. And this is where Michelle will talk through some of the specific findings. But we coordinated a lot of work with all of these different bureaus, county departments, many, many individuals, because they are the experts. And so we equipped them to make sure we were all starting with the same understanding of the science, the physical impacts that we are expecting, and then we relied on their expertise to play those through. How will that change the services you provide, demand for them, the way you deliver them, our ability to accommodate all these changes? And so I think one of the outcomes of this process is that city and county staff across a whole wide range of interests are engaged, informed. They are expert in doing this. And so the capacity building that has resulted is a really very constructive and kind of essential outcome, where it's not simply a report, but a lot of us are now much more plugged into how these changes will affect our daily work as the city and county. So what you have in front of you are two documents. The orange one is a fairly technical risk and vulnerability assessment that goes through what are these physical changes we're expecting and then plays it out across these different categories of infrastructure, natural systems, human health, other kinds of services. And then the shorter document with the picture on the cover is the proposed strategy. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do about it? And so I'm going to turn it over to Michelle to talk through those. And I guess I'd leave just one analogy that guides this whole effort, which is, and I'm borrowing this from someone else, but as we prepare for climate change, we can't assume that the future climate looks the same as it has in the past. It's sort of analogous to driving forward while looking in the rearview mirror. which sounds crazy, but actually can work fine if you're on a really straight road. But all the evidence is this road is not straight. And so this work is trying to have us look out through the front windscreen. And it's a little cloudy. We can't see everything perfectly, but we can see a heck of a lot better than just looking in the rearview mirror and trying to gauge the future by what we see behind us.
Thank you. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning. Michelle Krum with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So I'm going to just walk you through briefly some of the primary risks and vulnerabilities that were identified in that orange covered document, and then highlight some of the types of actions that are contained in the strategy. So the risk and vulnerability assessment identified five primary risks that we feel are a priority for Portland, and they generally fall in two seasons. And so for summer, we're looking at projections of hotter, drier summers with more high heat days. So this means that we would be expecting to see higher average daily temperatures, but also that we would expect not to cool off as much at night. And we're also, there are projections for more heat waves. So those temperature increases then are likely to be exacerbated by a phenomenon known as the urban heat island effect. And the map on this slide here shows some early work that was done by PSU to identify the urban heat islands in Portland. So these are the areas in an urban environment that are hotter than the surrounding rural areas. And you can see here the parts of town that are cooler in the blue, places like Forest Park or neighborhoods that have higher tree canopy cover. And then the areas of the city that tend to be warmer. So these, you know, you can see major roads like 82nd, Sandy, MLK, downtown industrial areas. So these are parts of the city that tend to be hotter relative to the other areas. And so this map was generated by some early work done at PSU. And currently researchers there are in the process of gathering more measurements across the city and the county, actually, and will be soon coming out with a more detailed map that will show the entire county so we can see what the urban heat islands look like there. These temperatures and the exacerbation with the urban heat island create certainly significant issues from a public health perspective related to heat-related illnesses like heat stroke and heat exhaustion. It can also reduce the water quality in our streams. It can change impact operations at the wastewater treatment plant. Can also result in impacts to the transportation infrastructure, such as pavement buckling or rail warping. You probably have maybe experienced or seen when temperatures climb above 90 degrees, TriMet needs to slow the trains down because the overhead cables get hotter and they start to sag a little bit, which means they need to slow the trains down for safety reasons. So these temperatures can also, in addition to public health, can affect our transportation and natural systems as well. Two other big risks associated with hotter, drier summers and more high heat days include drought and wildfire. Drier summers can lower stream flows and increase issues with invasive species, and also can put stress on our green infrastructure facilities. The increased potential for wildfire, not just in the urban-wildland interface, but also wildfires in the region can impact local air quality, and we've seen some of that in recent months as well, and that certainly has public health impacts related to triggering asthma or other underlying medical conditions. On the upside, in terms of water supply, based on the latest population and demand estimates and the expected performance of Portland's water supply system, the Portland Water Bureau is confident that it has sufficient water supply resources for the next 30 years at a minimum. So moving into the winter, we're expecting warmer winters with the potential for more intense rain events, and this results in primary risks of flooding and landslides. And these occurrences like this can put increased demand on emergency response services, can impact our transportation and other infrastructure, and can cause, particularly flooding, can cause issues like bridge scour and can damage boat docks and other waterway facilities. In addition, as has been mentioned, it can create issues related to vector-borne disease. Mosquito populations can also result in increased mold spores, which can trigger asthma and other health issues. So the second document, which is the one with the picture of the people planning in the Green Street facility on the front, is the strategy. And the actions in that strategy, I would say, fall into four broad categories. And the majority of those actions fall into this first category, which is to keep doing what we're already doing. A lot of those risks that I just talked about, flooding, landslides, wildfire, are already risks that we face today. They are things we're experiencing today, and they are risks that we're working on addressing today. So in a lot of cases, we just need to keep doing what we're already doing. Some great examples of that in particular relate to our work around green infrastructure and natural resource protection and restoration efforts. Another category is getting ahead of some of the coming impacts. So we know that things might be, as Michael said, changing in the future. We're not necessarily on a straight road anymore. And so we need to get ahead of a couple of things. Some examples of actions in that category include, if we're having hotter, drier summers, Parks and BES have identified the need to look at different plant palettes. What are the plants that we're planting in our restoration work, Green Street facilities, trees, shrubs, et cetera, that are more likely maybe to be successful in these summer drought conditions in the future? Another example relates to public health, and as Commissioner Bailey mentioned, really needing to identify and understand how these impacts are likely to affect different populations, and there are some communities that are likely to be more vulnerable to some of these impacts, particularly heat, than others. And so we need to make sure that our emergency planning efforts and our communication strategies are prioritizing those communities. Another big category has to do with monitoring and research. City and county staff identified a variety of things that don't necessarily require that we take any action in the near term, but are things that we should keep our eye on so that we can better understand what's going on and be better prepared to take action when and if the time comes. A couple of examples of that include if we have more intense rain events in the winter, river levels may rise. How does that affect the number of bridge lifts that happen, and does that affect maintenance schedules on the bridges, for example? Another example might be if we have these increased temperatures, how does that change demand for park facilities, community centers, fountains, other recreational places where the community is maybe seeking those places out in an effort to cool off? And so what does that mean for parks in terms of their programming of their facilities, for example? And lastly, there are some cases where we need to employ what Michael said in terms of looking out of the front window instead of the rearview mirror as it relates to some key areas and decision-making processes that the city and county have. An example of that is asset management. The bureaus consider a variety of risks such as earthquakes or infrastructure aging when they are doing their asset management work, and so we need to incorporate climate change risks and vulnerabilities into that assessment as well. Another example is a comprehensive plan. We've been working to build climate change impacts and vulnerability into the goals and policies in the comprehensive plan to help ensure that we have a more resilient city in the future and that our land use decisions are taking climate change into account. So last, in conclusion, as we sort of our next steps are to continue building on the existing work that's going on, move into implementation, research, monitoring. And then secondarily, we are in the process of updating the 2009 Climate Action Plan. And so as we, in the past, the city and county's Climate Action Plan has predominantly focused on reducing carbon emissions. And so we'll be incorporating the key findings from this work into that update, that new Climate Action Plan, so that the city and county's climate plan will continue to focus on reducing emissions, but we'll also have this additional component, that second circle that Michael showed, that begins to bring in the preparation work as well. So with that, I'll turn it back to Susan. Thank you.
Questions for staff?
Question, Mayor. So two recent events in my life. One, some folks who've testified before the Blue Ribbon Commission looking at our utilities who've opined that the Water Bureau and the Bureau of Environmental Services don't do a great job of describing their work to the broader public. And second, Mike is smiling. Second is a Davis Hibbett's poll. It said that not only does no one know what we mean when we say green infrastructure, but the last slide said stop using the word infrastructure because it doesn't resonate with people. So it reminds me that since we're still actually in some places debating climate change, I mean, there are people in our community and state who are very prolific on this question. it suggests that one important piece of all this is how we talk to the public about it. And I think the extent to which we can be consistent across platforms in the city obviously strengthens our case, that we can use language that is accessible to people that maybe don't follow this as closely as the experts. And I just found it sobering that, apropos of nothing, Davis Hibbett said, stop using the word green infrastructure because we've had focus groups and no one knows what you're talking about. And so it ends up being another example of us talking to ourselves, but not necessarily to the people we're trying to serve and move. So I've asked my bureaus to come up with an alternative to green infrastructure, just because gray and green is going to be embedded in all of our work. We're not going to stop making progress. But I would just, as part of this exercise, ask humbly your help in for all of us and for our bureaus and how we talk about this work in a way that reaches people that maybe don't follow it as closely as the experts. And that includes the kinds of words we use and the framing of the issue, and then what are the opportunities we have on a regular basis to talk about this in ways that resonate.
Well, fair
and
enough.
I mean, take the challenge that, you know, we can always do better. Is the question is, what's the frame?
Yeah, I mean, fair enough, and I wish everyone well in coming up with a word that comes more trippingly off the tongue than infrastructure. But actually, Davis and Hibbett, as you probably recall, also did another survey recently called the Oregon Values and Beliefs Study. And one of the things I thought was interesting in that survey was that statewide, not just in Portland, but statewide, I think it was 75% of the respondents sided with a statement that said, climate change is real and I need to change my own life and habits to deal with that. So statewide. It was something like 75 or 78%. Somebody might know the specific number, but it was a very large majority statewide. And there was actually not that much of a difference between the perception of that issue here in Portland and in the rest of the state, which also was surprising to me. So I think we've got some understanding in the broad community about these issues, even if the words that we in government use aren't always resonant with people.
I totally agree, Charlie, and it's because I think the value system is there. It's how we tap into it. And you know, we've done something a little different at the Bureau of Environmental Services now, which is when we come forward with a green infrastructure project, we show both sides of the ledger. We show the environmental benefits, and some of which we say, you put a what price do you put on clean air, clean water, shade, temperature, lush settings at intersections. And then we do the other side of the ledger, which is it costs less than going a traditional gray approach. Harnessing nature costs less than just putting new pipes in and building our pipe capacity, since we can never have enough pipes doing that approach. So we're doing both. I just think that since I'm, you know, relatively new with my two assignments, the more coaching we get on how we talk about this and what are the most user-friendly terms that communicate our values to people that, as Charlie says, understand, that are connecting the dots and they understand the problem, and we just make sure that we're talking to them.
I really appreciate that. I think we've been working on climate change for 20-something years, and 98% of the time, I never talk about climate change. I talk about jobs, about the health of people, about making their homes more comfortable, about making it easier to get around. And so I totally agree with you that we need to talk about the things that people care about. And that's trees and water flowing and the other words you use. Sooner or later, then, people will get the infrastructure word and the sustainability word and the climate change words. But totally agree with where you're at.
Thank you. Other questions or comments for our staff before we call up our next panel?
One thing, which is that, and by the way, I think the administration has recently started using the term climate disruption, which I like a lot because, you know, change is good, right? Disruption is bad. But I also think it's sort of more technically accurate. One thing that, a great document. One thing I think we might consider in the future is talking about the need to prepare for the steps that I at least hope the federal government will take to reduce fossil fuel use, I think that we have to assume that either the world ends or at some point the federal government puts a price on carbon. And I think that it's worth talking about the vulnerability of our population to a price on carbon and saying that there are things we can do to mitigate that vulnerability. Like, let's assume that there's a carbon tax of X, which the scientists think would be necessary in order to put the economics in the right way. What does that mean in terms of how much people would have to spend in their cars if they continue driving the same amount? And explain that making it easier to take transit, walk, bike, et cetera, is a way of mitigating the impact of that cost. I think that's an important, that might not be, you know, where the public is right now, but I think it's, I mean, a realistic way of looking at it, an important way of looking at it. Another example is, this, Michael knows this is one of my favorite examples, because I think it's something that we all tends to be ignored. There's a huge carbon component to various kinds of food. And we know that, you know, beef, lamb, pork, et cetera, are much more carbon intensive than, for example, lentils, which are one of the prime examples of a low carbon food. So I think part of preparing for the federal government putting a price on carbon would be explaining to people that when there's a price on carbon, beef and lamb will cost more and lentils will cost a lot less. So I actually think that, you know, classes in preparing delicious lentil soup should be part of our climate change mitigation adaptation strategy. So, I mean, that's just, I mean, the general point is we should, I mean, the right wing talks about how, well, if there's a price on carbon, then that's the end of the world. I think that we should acknowledge that if there's a price on carbon, there is an economic impact, but there are strategies to mitigate that impact.
Good discussion. Thank you all very much. So I think it's, did you say Joanne Fuller and Mike Houck and Dean Marriott are going to
yes,
come up next?
Please.
Okay.
Thank you.
Please do, and thank all three of you.
Mike, we'll be grading you today on your communication skills through your presentation.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Joanne Fuller, and I'm your health department director, because as the health department director for the county, I also represent public health for the whole community. And so it's my pleasure to be here today to talk to you about the public health impacts that are reflected in this report and the strategies that we're going to be using to try to address those public health impacts. I first want to acknowledge the staff of the health department. Susan acknowledged the staff of the health department and their work in providing this report. I want to acknowledge the work of Lillian Shirley, who served as the health department director during the time period in which this report was prepared, and really brought forward the concept that public health has a role to play in transportation and infrastructure planning, because there are choices that can be made in those processes that can be positive for public health and can be detrimental to public health. And so we're really happy to continue that partnership with the city in doing that work. I'm going to be very brief. There is significant public health impact for populations for climate change. That shouldn't surprise anybody. There are areas that we expect to happen more rapidly than others, and that's where we're focusing in this work. One of the first impacts is increased heat-related illness. This affects populations differently. Seniors are physically more vulnerable to heat-related illness. People who are homeless, people who work outdoors, people who don't have air conditioning are all going to be populations that are going to be disproportionately impacted by an increase in high temperatures, which then results in heat-related illness. And so we need to try to address that on a population-by-population effort. Increases in respiratory diseases such as asthma. We know that as there is heat, as there is increased pollution, as there are increased particulates in the air, populations are more affected by respiratory illnesses. And in particular, you know, you've been hearing from communities of color, poor and disadvantaged communities that live closer to transportation like freeways and industrial sites are going to be more impacted by this. And so we know that we need to work community by community with people to try to help create ways to both prevent and then address respiratory illnesses as they increase. And then changes in vector-borne diseases like West Nile virus. We talked about flooding, talked about wetter winters. That creates an opportunity for changes in our vector population. We need to tackle that while still maintaining habitat, right? We don't want to just obliterate our wetlands and eliminate the habitat that is oftentimes associated with those vectors. So we need to make sure that we are doing what we can about that.
Joanne, what do we mean when we say vector-borne illnesses? I mean, that's a term of art, but what do we
mean? Yes, we're primarily talking about mosquitoes in this, so mosquitoes as carriers of diseases. So when we think about public health, we think about health equity. You've been hearing from the Coalition of Communities of Color. You heard this morning from them about the Slavic community and disparate disparities. There are in America and there are in our community real disparities in terms of health equity among different racial and ethnic populations. And so we need to think more about what we can do to outreach to communities that may have physical or may not have the physical or economic adaptability to deal with the greater health risks that that we're looking at in the future. So what that looks like is you were talking about translating materials into languages. Part of what that looks like is outreaching to communities and engaging in a conversation, working on building social supports and physical supports to try to help communities that don't have the same economic advantages be able to address the issues that are increasing for them. One of the challenges that we've got right now is that we go into these climate change environment with already existing health disparities. And so part of what we're doing in the health department is trying to engage in broad strategies to address those health disparities as we go in. And then we know that those disparities are going to kind of be a pile-on effect as climate change impacts different communities different than others. So what kinds of strategies are we talking about? We're talking about educating populations about heat-related illness. In the last year, we created a toolkit that was one of the first of its kind to try to get to reach seniors and other vulnerable populations in the community to try to help them both identify when they're involved in heat-related illness and figure out what steps they could do to address that and to prevent it. And so that's the kind of thing that we need to be able to do sort of population by population as we work on these efforts. We're working to track the impact of high ozone days on health and develop strategies for making sure that vulnerable populations in the languages that they speak know about their vulnerability. We're looking at air quality improvements. We have a grant right now that's going to be working with schools to try to develop curriculum, pilot curriculum, to help teachers to teach about climate change, and in particular to help students think about air quality. One of the things to think about is the connection of how you get to school, meaning in a car, and air quality that happens in your community. And so really trying to connect the dots for people about their individual actions and how that affects their health. And then managing vector populations in a way that we can both protect human health but also ensure that we continue to maintain ecological diversity in our natural mm-hmm. environments. And then we need to track some emerging issues. One of the things that people are talking about these days is climate refugees. And you know that we live in a climate that is predicted to be less impacted than some other areas around us. And as we experience climate refugees, we're going to be experiencing more stress on the population. We may experience people who come here. We don't have places for them to live. And we may be experiencing higher issues of mental health as depression and stress as people are dealing with both the economic and social impacts of climate change on their lives. Thank you.
Just one quick question. If we have a major snowstorm, we invoke our Disaster Policy Council if necessary. If there's inclement weather, we have a plan that attempts to mitigate the impacts on people experiencing homelessness and a plan that goes into action. if we have a stretch of really hot weather, and we know it has a negative impact on older adults, do we have a health response plan that is similar in terms of directing people to cooling centers and places where they can escape the heat? And is that in place, or is it a work in progress?
That's a work in progress, and that's a part of what we need to build with this. We have taken some actions that I would consider sort of intermediate steps between nothing and having a complete plan. For example, the county has opened libraries for extended hours and published that that's a place that people could go to stay cool with the air conditioning during those days that are of extreme heat. We have case managers that have outreached to particularly vulnerable populations of elderly and disabled people, but we haven't kind of taken the next step to really sort of open what might be the equivalent of the disaster relief center that was like the cooling center for people to be able to go.
I remember a few years ago when I was Parks Commissioner, we had a spell of really hot weather, so we used our community centers as cooling centers, and we put the word out, and people could come and be in an air-conditioned space, and that's interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think we need to continue to work on that plan. Yeah.
Great. Thanks very much, Joanne.
Actually, Jan, I just wanted to say that I am glad that we brought up mosquitoes specifically, because I think that people might not recognize climate disruption as an enemy, but they recognize mosquitoes as the enemy. And if we develop a line of saying something like, every time you burn a gallon of gas, a mosquito gets its wings, maybe that would be helpful.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Good morning, Mayor Hales, members of the council. I'm Dean Marriott, Environmental Services Director. So the Bureau of Environmental Services really is going to be on the front lines as far as dealing with climate change. The public has invested over $13 billion so far to allow us to clean sewage and manage stormwater every day to keep Portlanders safe and to protect our environment. Now, changing rain patterns, as you've heard, could impact public safety by increasing flooding. They could adversely impact our urban watersheds and put into risk all the good investments we've already made to restore our watershed health. And increasing temperatures and rainfall could affect the wastewater treatment process itself. We were very pleased to play a major role in the interbureau teams working on this climate preparation report. Now, Portland is a leader in implementing solutions designed with nature in mind. Treating stormwater using green solutions helps to cool and clean the rivers and streams, which will be getting warmer with climate change. Green streets, green roofs, green parking lots are all flexible ways for dealing with increasing rain events. They're much more flexible than a particular sized pipe that you put in the ground, and then you have to rely on that. So these green solutions continue our efforts to manage stormwater, our day-to-day business, and they help us sequester CO2, and which helps move the city closer to meeting its goals for the Climate Action Plan. Now, studies are finding, for instance, that eco-roofs, which we've invested a lot in here in Portland, can be an important tool toward moving buildings toward climate neutrality, carbon neutrality. So the climate change preparation strategy and the risks and vulnerability report that you've already been briefed about this morning are instrumental in connecting solutions. Just for example, trees, we've been planting a lot of trees to benefit us for stormwater and urban watershed health. They're also the same trees that are going to help alleviate the urban heat island effect, which you've just heard about. And we've been very pleased to work alongside Planning and Sustainability, Multnomah County, our other city party bureaus that are our partners in this, also our local nonprofit organizations like Friends of Trees that have been working hard on this issue for many years. We're happy to be a part of the solutions to this problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good. Mayor Hales, Commissioners, my name is Mike Houck. I'm here today because Andre Baugh, our chair of the Planning Sustainability Commission, wasn't able to be here and ask if I could stand in for him. In August, we voted as a commission unanimously to recommend that you adopt these two documents. Staff has briefed and updated the Planning Sustainability Commission throughout the development process and shared all of the work they've done doing public outreach and so forth. The Commission commends staff for creating a well-researched and strategic climate change preparation strategy. preparation strategy considers the impacts that underserved and underrepresented Portlanders may experience as a result of climate change, and prioritizes preparation actions in communities most likely to be vulnerable to climate change impacts, such as the urban heat island effect. The Commission is pleased to see that the key findings and actions from a climate change preparation strategy will be integrated into the city and county's updated climate action plan. This plan is an example, excellent example of cross-bureau and cross-jurisdiction collaboration, and we ask that the city continue to work with surrounding jurisdictions, particularly Metro, as responding to climate change is clearly a regional issue. And in fact, yesterday I spent the part of the morning talking with Metro Councilor Bob Stacey about this very issue, and basically giving him a heads up that the Planning and Sustainability Commission is very interested in Metro expanding beyond its very currently very narrowly focused mitigation strategy that the state has mandated Metro and the region address with regard to reduction of greenhouse gases. I really do think, and I'm pleased to hear the conversation about green infrastructure, because responding both for mitigation and preparation to climate change is going to really require us to ramp up on green infrastructure, whether that's the appropriate term we use or not. And by the way, my critique of the City of Portland's, especially Bureau of Environmental Services, communication with the public really didn't have anything to do with language. It had more to do with bragging about the incredible work that the Bureau has done, the Big Pipe Project and all the other excellent work that the Bureau of Environmental Services and the city, the rest of the city, is doing. So it's more about really letting people know what tremendous successes we've had than any language issues. Commissioner Fish, actually, I think you used potentially one of the ways to communicate with the public, and that is you said use the term harnessing nature. I think people get the term green. I think they get the term nature or natural systems. A lot of people, in fact, say natural infrastructure as opposed to green infrastructure. So I would agree we need to ramp up our communication with the public and make sure we're being clear. What that terminology may be, I don't know. But
there's a contest underway, I think.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for your service and continuing volunteer service. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Do we have others signed up to speak on this item?
Yes, we have five more people signed up. Mary Eng, Ben Pickering, and Crystal Ilinski. I think they're both out of the room. And we'll go with Daniela Broad and Scott Fogarty right now.
Okay, come on up, Danielle and Scott.
Hi, it's a pleasure to see you, Council, and thank you so much for the 3 minutes allotted to citizens to speak on such items as per the city charter. I wanted to bring up, mucho thanks to Steve Novick for bringing up the idea about diet. I was going to hit that one, and I thought I might be really left-wing to, like, come out of the vegan closet here, because you always hear me talking about so many other issues. But I think that one way to make it a little less threatening and scary for people is some of the campaigning around that. It centers around maybe meatless Mondays, or just doing it on a gradual basis, or incorporating more healthy plant-based diet in just even one meal a day or something. So thank you very much. And I heard a great thing on NPR the other day about what's happening in Los Angeles with drought-resistant plant incentives, where people who convert what would formerly be extensively watered lawns into drought-resistant planting zones with sage and succulents are getting some kind of incentive from either the Water Bureau or, I believe it is something, or property tax or something, but we could maybe try to find a way to help people manage that on their own local basis. And then I thought about bringing up another idea called guerrilla gardening, which I heard about. Basically, it's kind of like a do-it-yourself punk rock thing to just take a little space that seems completely neglected and throw some plants on it, and that when people start even using tiny little bits of plotting to grow some vegetables and things, we can do something to improve the food basis. And then I just kind of wanted to map out for you my own struggles with this smog. And I moved to Los Angeles in 2003. By 2005, I was having cramped lungs where I was in pain surrounding the smog, but I loved being in a multicultural city and a lot of the opportunities that arose there. I moved back in 2007 and then moved back to Portland in 2010, so I've kind of had this back and forth thing. But for me, I thought of going to Portland as this green mecca and, oh, finally I can breathe and I don't feel like I'm suffocating. But what I find is you might have to say sayonara to me eventually because the air in Washington is just fabulous. And the time I spent there, I felt like a calling to come back to Portland and help and participate and engage. But I also felt that there's an environmental refugee pattern even in my own life where I may seek more verdant pastures and green air.
Thank you.
Also, Ms. Alinsky wanted me to read her statement. I don't know if that's permissible.
Just leave it with Carla. Thank you.
All right. I'm glad to hear it resonate the mind. Just you know, there's a lot of ideas out here, and Lydia brought up with landslides going on. You know, it's like the earth gets dry, and then it puts water on it, and it causes land. We just had a landslide not too long ago over in Washington, and it was devastating. It hurt a lot of people, but. Another thing I was wanting to bring up, too, is, like, the water issue. I mean, you always see the guys come down off the Logan Mountain roads, and they always build these trucks and vehicles and different things. And the world's quick on really building buildings and doing stuff like that. But, like, in time, if you were to, like, process it, I mean, is it possible? I mean, they bottle up water, but, I mean, it would help, too, like, when they make sandbags and cause up, you know, cause different floods to stop flooding so they don't get around their house, or they use sandbags, you know, when flooding happens. But like if they made factories, you know, they make these big garbage cans and these big crates and different things, but you know, when you take something and you put it under water, it fills up with water. But I mean, it'd be cool, like, if they made a factory that made square things. I mean, in time, I don't know, in a year's time, if you had a way of just hauling crates and then like using the crate bottling up the ocean. I mean, we were surrounded by numerous bodies of water. But I mean, like factories where they have, you know, make crates that are big enough to where you can capture the water, you know, and then put it in areas where you could use it for blocks, and so many of them, like just blocks where you could use it to block water too and make, you know, so many of them. You know what I'm seeing? I'm saying, but. I know, it's just the idea. I mean, everybody comes up with all kinds of other things. And two, like mosquitoes, they got like the candle things that you go around, and you light them, and they kind of keep the mosquitoes off. But they got the strips too. I don't know, or the spray stuff. But what if they had like something, you know, rather? I mean, I always see there's tons of kids and stuff. They had something about the mosquitoes going around, and people. I mean, not everybody in the world hears all about all the things that go on, and mosquitoes and the viruses and different things. But like, I mean. You know, they had, like, the strip trees where you could, like, it's like a blanket you put around a tree, and it just kind of keeps them from the radius of something, that, you know, where they got the spray stuff. But, I mean, what if they made stuff like that? Or, I mean, and if it made it, you know, safely, and I don't know. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Good morning and welcome. Yeah. Who's next? Go ahead.
Hi, Mayor and Commissioners. Good to see you again. So I want to say thank you to the my name's Danella Bright. I live in Southwest Portland. Thank you to the Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability for creating the Climate Action Plan, for doing the risk assessment, and especially for the Climate Preparation Report. As some of you know, I used to work for the city, and for 17 years, I worked for the local creeks and rivers and the neighborhoods that straddled them. My last assignment was leading a $50 million initiative to build and plant more green natural infrastructure in the city, and as a way to meet our regulatory obligations while saving money and providing multiple benefits important for a high-quality urban life. I'm here today as a mom of two young children. I brought with me Nora, who's 4. I'm a lifelong Portland resident and a fourth-generation Oregonian. I'm here to say that climate change is the number one issue of our time. When I'm not mothering my children, I'm working with a national nonpartisan nonprofit group called the Citizens Climate Lobby to pass a revenue neutral fee on carbon. In June, I was in D.C. with 650 other volunteers when I met and talked with several members of Congress and their staff. I had the privilege to visit with Senator Merkley when he said, "We are here, and this moment is the test of mankind." There is an urgency that national action now in the next 3 to 7 years is necessary to avoid global catastrophe. We are very hopeful that we will reach our national objective, but we do not have any delusional ideas that the problem will go away anytime soon. The main point I want to make here is that in the context of this urgency to act now to get carbon emissions out of our national and global economy, it's imperative that we realize we have huge and long-lasting lag effect that we will have to deal with. And the best place to do this preparation and adaptation is at the local level, right here in Portland. And why do I care about this? I worry about my children and their ability to enjoy the same things I do. As our climate changes, we will start to realize that if we haven't already, that our parks and our green spaces are our cooling systems, that our fellow birds and animals are our source of joy and inspiration. We will eventually realize that our fellow human beings who have less than we do are feeling the impacts of hotter, dirtier air more acutely than we are. I'm working hard for my children to get a good education and become productive members of society, and I hate the thought that it will be harder for them than it is for me. I have two requests. The preparation report is very important. I implore the bureaus to pay attention to it and to find the time and resources to implement its actions. It will not be necessary to require additional programs or resources. It will, however, take prioritization and moving certain projects and programs up in the schedule. I request that you set up systems to prioritize these actions for funding. Secondly, please scale up efforts to include Metro. It makes no sense that Portland is doing climate preparation and not Metro. Metro's value to this region is regional scale and that regional coordination, which is so important with a systemic and large-scale problem like climate change. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Thanks for your advocacy.
Danilov, it's nice to see you again. Nora, you are absolutely the best behaved young lady. I am very, very impressed about your patience sitting with your mom and doing so nicely. Thank you very much.
Nice job. Thank you both. Mr. Fogarty, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, just push the little button in there and it will light
there
up.
Go.
There you go.
All right. Thank you very much. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. I want to congratulate you on this really excellent award. I think it's really a testament to what the leadership of this city is doing and what the partnerships that have evolved from this topic have accomplished. And I applaud you and your efforts. Actually, let me back up. Nora's also a tree lover, by the way. she said she likes to climb apple trees, right? And she drew me a little picture while we were sitting up there.
Wow.
So, yeah, she's cool. A very good girl. but I want to applaud your efforts and excuse me, and your staff efforts at addressing climate change and for this very bold, I think, and very encouraging resolution. I'm very encouraged that Multnomah County is involved as well. I think clearly these topics have no boundaries in terms of geography, and we need to look at it holistically. And while I understand the bulk of the push is to reduce our carbon output, we also have to think about, and I noticed it in the presentation, about sequestering that carbon. And at Friends of Trees, we take this very seriously. We feel that a healthy urban forest sequesters carbon in the wood and in the soil and in the roots of the trees that we help plant. And a healthy urban forest touches on every one of the topics that we've heard about today. It addresses things like human health. It addresses things like air quality. It addresses things like energy use, because if you plant trees on the west and south side of your home, in the hot months of the summer, your energy use will be reduced because you don't have to use as much air conditioning. So it's a holistic approach, and Friends of Trees is very serious about taking this approach. We're also looking at what we call our Climate Trees program. We have worked with some nurseries to plant specific trees that can be drought and more heat resistant. They aren't your typical trees that you'd look at normally in the Northwest, but we are looking forward to see what kind of species will thrive in these conditions to mitigate heat island effect and summer drought issues that we heard about. Also, during the winter and spring months, trees basically help reduce the stormwater flow, the flow of water into the stormwater system at the front end. So the whole year round, our urban forest is working at a very low cost, high return value to us. And finally, we specifically, Friends of Trees, work in the low income, low canopy neighborhoods. And you saw the heat island effect graphic up there. A lot of those neighborhoods we've been working in very specifically for the past 10 years. And I'm pleased to say this year, our 25th year, by the way, we're offering $25 trees in those neighborhoods to help citizens be able to afford a cheaper tree that will help mitigate a lot of these issues. Now, trees aren't the panacea, but I know you value these assets for the multiple benefits they provide to our community. And as we move towards a warmer planet, I advocate